From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This state has been hit hard economically by a shrinking U.S. auto industry and the ripple effects of the mortgage crisis. This state has also produced a legendary music empire and is home to some of the best colleges in the nation. We are talking about Michigan. It's primary day and voters get to weigh in on the presidential candidates. And NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is with us to break down how the candidates are faring in the march to the White House. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So let's hear an explanation about this primary situation in Michigan. There's changes to the Republican delegates. The Democrats only have one candidate on the ballot. What's going on?
I will give you my best explanation, but I'm not sure I can make sense of it for anyone, Farai, because this is a confused and difficult situation. The state of Michigan decided it wanted to be taken more seriously in the primary process. It wanted to be like Iowa and New Hampshire. So it leapfrogged a bunch of other states, went way out of February all the way up to January 15th with its primary. Immediately, the Republican National Committee said, that's going to cost you half your delegates because you broke our rules. And the Democrats got even more upset and said, we're going to take away all 156 delegates for the state of Michigan. And what's more, we're going to forbid the candidates to campaign there, and we're going to tell them to take their names off the ballot. Well, most of the candidates complied with all of those rules, but a few candidates are still on the ballot. Hillary Clinton is the only major candidate still on the ballot, but you've also got Dennis Kucinich's name on there, Mike Gravel's name, and Chris Dodd's, and Chris Dodd has already dropped out of the campaign.
When you think about what's going on with Michigan making this move unilaterally, do you think that the political parties will actually go through with all of the threats that they've threatened Michigan's delegates with?
I think that the national committees, the Republican National Committee, the Democratic National Committee, will hold fast. But what we'll probably see happen is somewhere between now and the conventions, which come at the very end of this summer, the candidate who appears to be on his or her way to being the nominee of the major parties will say, we want Michigan to come home. We want to have all those Michigan delegates come. And they will welcome them in. Now, that will happen so long as there is a candidate who is clearly going to win the nomination at the convention. If, on the other hand, either party has the kind of situation where the convention will have to choose between several candidates who have a chance of being the nominee still at that point, then we're going to have a very sticky situation, because then who you bring from Michigan and whom they're going to vote for is going to make a potential difference to the outcome of the convention, and then whether or not they're seated will be a very hot controversy indeed.
Very briefly, Ron, is this a make it or break it for any of the candidates, Republican or Democratic?
I think it's quite a crucial one on the Republican side. I don't think it has a great deal of meaning on the Democratic side because of what we've just discussed. But on the Republican side, either Mitt Romney or John McCain is going to be in serious trouble after losing today. So Mitt Romney has lost several places where he concentrated his resources. This is his native state. He really needs to win here. But John McCain, by the same token, while he's leading in the national poll now, needs to find a place he can win other than New Hampshire. If he doesn't win here, he breaks his momentum. He's going to have trouble finding his next winning primary day.
Well, Ron, we will definitely keep checking in with you. Thanks again.
Good to be with you.
We've been speaking with NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He spoke with us from our studios in Washington, D.C. And now a closer look at the Democratic race that's dealing with race. Over the past few days, there have been a lot of mentions of the race card, but who is playing it? For more on this, we've got Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, and Roland Martin, a CNN contributor and special correspondent for Essence magazine. Welcome, gentlemen.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So things are heating up in more ways than one, and a lot has been said over the past few days about the back and forth between the Clinton camp and the Obama camp surrounding race. The bottom line is, anyone actually throwing the race card, or is this just politics as usual? I'm going to go to you first, Roland.
Well, I think when you say throw the race card, I interviewed Shelby Steele on my radio show, and he talked about his book, A Bound Man, and he said there's no doubt for him the Clinton campaign was throwing the race card. I talked to many others who said they sense that there's race baiting and that Obama does not want to have a conversation. He really doesn't want to have a conversation about race. I mean, his campaign people flat out are skittish about this topic. And so when you talk about what's the race card, well, when Bill Shaheen makes a comment addressing, you know, will they say he was a drug dealer? People read something into that. And then, of course, then you hear New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo make a comment about shucking and jiving. And so, well, is he talking about Obama? And then what happens? They say, well, no, I wasn't talking about him. And then the whole brouhaha, which I don't think was a big deal over Clinton's MLK comments and then Bill Clinton's comments about fairy tale. And so that's where I think people are getting this sort of coded words being thrown out that may not fit in the category of the race card, but may be in the same family.
I'm going to throw in a little bit more gasoline on the fire. There were comments from the Hillary camp, and then Bill Clinton brought on the controversy surrounding race. Now we have some comments by BET founder Bob Johnson that have reignited the flames. Let's take a listen.
As an African American, I am insulted that the Obama campaign would imply that we are so stupid that we would think Hillary and Bill Clinton, who have been deeply and emotionally involved in black issues, when Barack Obama was doing something in the neighborhood that I won't say what he was doing, but he said it in his book.
Robert, what was that wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and how did it play out?
Well, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge was most definitely an allusion to the drug use, and Johnson obviously was trying to possibly the way Bill Shaheen, the Hillary's former co-chair in New Hampshire, was alluding to that since Obama has admitted to not just smoking pot, but actually using cocaine. Now the political game is, well, you know, was it more than just using it? Was he possibly distributing it? So I'm not quite sure whether that's necessary. It's exactly an aspect of, say, the race card. Now, it is incredibly disingenuous for Robert Johnson to say, "Oh, I wasn't referring to drugs. I was referring to his community organizing in Chicago," which is absolutely silly. So, I'm not necessarily sure if that really is considered part of the race card, but it is certainly a kind of a generational cultural knife that the Clintons are certainly going to try and use against Obama.
What's interesting is he talks about it when he was, you know, a teenager. Yet, I mean, let's think about it. Fred Thompson, a former U.S. senator, he was riding around on airplanes of a guy who very recently, as in the last decade, who was busted for trying to distribute cocaine. I mean, somebody who actually did it, riding the plane, a huge campaign supporter. That story had a shelf life maybe of a couple of days. Now, granted, I think part of that is because he's not a front runner. He's sort of the middle of the pack right now. But there's an illusion.
Roland, we're talking about the candidate as opposed to the candidate's associate.
Roland, let me redirect this a little bit, and Robert, you can jump in. The question comes to mind for me of proxies. There are the candidates, and then there are people who are proxying for the candidates.
Yes,
surrogates.
Yes, exactly. And so in this case, you have Bob Johnson being a proxy for the Hillary Clinton camp, African-American man, hyper-wealthy. What does it mean to have what some people would call crab-in-a-barrel syndrome? Is that even a fair characterization of one black man being used as a proxy against another black man?
No, I think what you have here is, and actually I was on a debate with Bob Johnson, and I also talked with him regarding his comments, and he said, look, the Clintons are friends of mine. If they are in a fight, I'm in a fight. And that's what you have here. That's what surrogates do. And the politicians use them to say, well, no, I didn't say it. They said it. And so if you're concerned, you need to give them a call.
Robert, you already had a situation where one of the people working for the Clinton campaign was let go because of pushing the cocaine issue. Is this not just the cocaine issue, but could these racial issues be a third rail for anyone attacking Barack Obama? Is Senator Barack Obama's nice guy image one where he actually could gain some support, sympathy support?
Yes and no. In the context of the Clintons, they have to be very, very careful because the African-American community is a significant base of the Democratic Party. And they cannot be seen as if they're trying to use race to bait Obama and to gain explicit political advantage, because that same base they need, if Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee, they need that same base to turn out for turn out for her.
Is it all fair in love and politics during the primaries, or do the Democrats have to think about, are we in a circular firing squad? How much do you have to play nice during the primaries with people of your own party?
Roland? Well, first of all, when you're running for president, your job is to win the nomination. I mean, so you worry about that drama later. Everybody always said, oh, let's not attack one another because we don't want the Republicans to use this against us. But you have to win the nomination to even get to the general election. And so you're going to do everything you can to win. That's just the bottom line. And so all the people who want the nice little campaigns, guess what? They're the ones who dropped out. It's only three standing. Well, four with Dennis Kucinich, but essentially they're three standing. But you got to be real careful when you all of a sudden when you have a woman, U.S. senator, who could win the nomination, an African-American who could win the nomination, that's very careful that they have to step because, again, women are going to make 60% of those who are voting. African-Americans are a significant, loyal group within the Democratic Party. You don't want to tick either one off. You do have to tread carefully.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We just talked about race and politics with Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. He spoke with us from our studios in New York, and Roland Martin, CNN contributor and special correspondent for Essence magazine. From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Detroit is gearing up for a spectacular car show that starts this weekend. But even this event won't do much to mask an auto industry on the skids. Plants are closing. Auto workers have been laid off by the thousands. Michigan's unemployment rate has soared to the highest in the nation. The state is struggling. It's a major issue, especially for black voters. And joining me now to talk about what's on the mind of Michigan's black folk this political season, we've got Jimmy Green, president of the Michigan Black Republican Party, also Jerome Vaughn, news program director for member station WDET in Detroit. Jerome and Jimmy, welcome.
Hello.
Glad to be with you.
So, Jerome, let me start with you. Michigan's economy, it's just a huge issue, an important topic for voters as they head to the polls. Can you give me a quick overview of how African Americans are being affected?
Well, they are among the people being hurt the worst, definitely here in Metro Detroit and throughout the state with this poor economy. Unemployment is through the roof, twice the national average. For those who do have jobs, many African Americans are underemployed. They may be holding down two or three jobs to make ends meet. And often people who have retired are having a hard time making ends meet as well. The economy is really the main issue for African American voters, one of the main issues here in Michigan.
Now, Jimmy, there is a concentration of African Americans in Detroit. It has the largest African American population of the top 10 major U.S. cities, percentage-wise, 83% African Americans. Now, with that kind of what some sociologists call hyper-segregation, how does it affect the power of the black vote or the ability of people to be heard that people are so concentrated?
Interestingly enough, and I certainly concur with everything Jerome said about the issues of that are facing African Americans here in Michigan. I think that Detroit brings a core issue to mind. The fact that you have such a heavy concentration of African Americans in Detroit who are, for whatever reasons, primarily Democratic voters, I think it has taken Detroit off the radar screen in terms of political clout as it hits Lansing, which is our capital city, needless to say, where a legislature is predisposed toward those constituencies or those markets that are more Republican-based. So you see areas like Grand Rapids, for example, the western side of the state or the northern side of the state, that reap the benefits where the vote, whether Democrat and Republican, are more dispersed than they are in Detroit, Michigan, where if it's not a completely controlled Democratic Congress, Senate, and governorship, it makes it very difficult for them to stay on the radar screen on a consistent basis. And I think that's eroded Detroit's effectiveness in Lansing.
You are a Republican, and yet it sounds like you think that Detroit is being underserved by the state government?
I wouldn't put it that way. I would certainly say that Detroit is probably not fairly represented in Lansing because, again, of its leaning toward the Democratic Party. There's no balance there. So when things go to committee or when things go to the House, and there isn't a voice on the other side of the aisle, I think those kind of issues get pushed to the side. But I think that would be true in any city, whether it's urban city or suburban cities. If you don't have a voice in the room where decisions are made, your voice loses its power. I think Detroit is certainly affected by that. Detroit's been on the radar screen for a long time, over the last 8 years in particular, and because it's had sort of a monolithic political affiliation, I just don't think it's been able to sustain its clout. And as we shift back into more moderate or even in some circles Republican politics, you'll start to find Detroit get pushed further and further away.
Jerome, when you think about your city and covering it as a newsman, what are you really looking to accomplish, you know, around election 08 and how your state and your city play into that election?
Well, really, I look for, you know, an opportunity to get to know the voters, to really talk to them, see what sort of issues are important to them. As I said, the economy is something very important to them. Another thing that's really come out of the situation with the Democrats, the National Committee sanctioning Michigan is the voters here are really pretty mad. African Americans feel disenfranchised. They feel like they don't have the opportunity to vote for Barack Obama or John Edwards or whoever else they want to vote for, in many cases Barack Obama, but they don't have that opportunity, and so they feel cheated. They feel disenfranchised because of that, and that's something that's really been coming out lately as well. And they're looking for solutions. They want Michigan to do better. They want the auto industry to do better. They want Detroit to do better. In many cases, up until a few months ago, you know, they really felt like this was the only place in the country that was not doing well before the subprime crisis really arose so greatly. They really felt like, hey, what's wrong with us? Why isn't anyone helping us? And so there's a lot of frustration with that as well that is still simmering here in Detroit.
Very true.
Jimmy, do you think that the move of the primary sort of against the rules of the political parties may have backfired?
Absolutely. I mean, without question, the Republicans in this state will get a voice. I mean, that, and I keep echoing and being redundant about the word voice, but I think it's critical. The Republicans will and do have a voice today on January 15th in their primaries. The Democrats don't. That voice is muted, needless to say. It's one of the things that being a party or being a part of the National Black Republican Party is, it's not a fad or a trend, needless to say, but it's to provide alternative voices. You know, I think Jerome and I would agree about what's wrong with Detroit or what's wrong with inner cities, period. I think there may be some, there may be a lot of contention about the methodologies on how to get things like that done, but I think we all have the same root analysis. And I believe, and it's one of the reasons why I spearhead Republican values, is that if it's another alternative to create a positive change in communities where long Democratic rule have not.
Jerome, when you go out and you interview people, talk to people, have your members for your station call in, do people have hope? Do people suggest solutions? How are people looking forward?
Well, I think people in Detroit have long had hope. They have this feeling of renewal, this Renaissance spirit that has been around for a long time. And even when things get very hard, like they did in the 1980s, when the auto industry wasn't doing so well, and this cyclical problem with the auto industry, Detroiters hold on. They find a way to find a foothold and move forward. And they're really looking for that now. I mean, I think a lot of African Americans have some hope that be it Barack Obama or be it Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side, and, you know, to a lesser degree, some of the Republican candidates can make a difference, can pull the state out of its doldrums and get it back on track, much like many other states have done, you know, done well. Chicago has done fairly well over the long period of time. Detroiters want to get to that sort of place, and so they have a lot of hope. They just want to see how quickly it gets to them.
Jimmy, same question, very, very brief. You were raised in Flint in the projects. What about folks across the state? Do you think people have hope?
I would think that in the face of Barack, yes, they do have hope. But I would also suggest, too, that I'm starting to hear a lot of voices say that the same old isn't getting things done in the black communities. And I think they're more predisposed to hear, at least, alternative voices. And that's all we hope to do anyway.
All right. Well, Jerome and Jimmy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Jerome Vaughn is news program director for member station WDET in Detroit. He joined me from their studios. And Jimmy Green is president of the Michigan Black Republican Party. This week on Africa Update, we're going to take a look at Kenya and Liberia. In Kenya, the battle for political leadership continues, and former Liberian President Charles Taylor finally stands trial for war crimes. For more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I'm glad to be back.
Yes, always glad to have you on. Now, a quarter of a million Kenyans have been displaced in this post-election violence, hundreds of people killed. And today, Kenya's newly elected parliament met for the first time. How did that unfold?
Well, I haven't seen the most recent reports, but the situation there remains grim because there is a basic political deadlock. The allegedly elected President Kibaki insists that the election was legitimate, and Odinga, the head of the opposition, says exactly the contrary. And Kibaki has essentially snubbed Kofi Annan, who was going to Kenya to attempt to mediate the situation. So the situation remains tense.
When there was this initial meeting, actually members of the opposition party refused to stand up when President Mwai Kibaki entered the chamber, and yet they were all there. Is that at least a hopeful sign that people are trying to negotiate these very tricky political waters?
Absolutely. And I think that what's critical is that the dispute in Kenya needs to focus at the level of politics as opposed to at the level of ethnicity. In other words, international observers generally believe that the elections were rigged. The response of the supporters of the opposition, their anger was very legitimate. The problem was that it got taken, demonstrated through ethnic violence rather than protest around the political establishment. So the continued focus on politics, the fact that people are meeting in parliament, I think is a very, very important step.
Now, a Chinese newspaper, The People's Daily, blamed the West and its pressure to push Western democracy on Kenya as the root cause of all this. How do you parse out an argument like that, that some nations, and this has been made sometimes by other people in the context of Muslim countries or various countries around the world, Western democracy is not a one-size-fits-all solution. Is that true in this case, or how do you make sense of that?
I think what we have to do is we have to separate the term into its two components, Western and democracy. Democracy is suited for any person on this planet. The notion of Western democracy, however, is something else. Western democracy basically means not so much a form, but the imposition of a certain way of doing things based on how it's done in London and Washington, D.C. And so I think that the Chinese criticism has a great deal of strength to it if you focus on the Western part of it. Now, if you take that apart and look at democracy, it's a different matter. Kenya needs democracy, but it needs democracy that's focused on Kenya, on the issue of issues such as that there are different ethnic groups that are there, that the borders of Kenya were not designed by Kenyans. You know, issues along those lines. I mean, democracy has to be understood in a much broader context than it is normally in the United States.
What's the next move, not just within the Kenyan community, but the international community to deal with the displaced, internally displaced persons?
Well, hopefully two aspects. One is that I do believe international pressure on President Kibaki is very, very important. I think that he has to understand that he may have stolen this election or engaged in conduct that might be interpreted that way, but that it will not be tolerated. I think that that's one piece. I think the second piece, though, and which is actually more important, is that within Kenya, the political opposition regroups and turns its followers away from non-Kikuyu, anti-ethnic or ethnic-based violence, and more towards putting the pressure on the Kibaki regime to shift.
Let's move on to the trial of former Liberian President Charles Taylor. It started last week. What crimes are, what is he accused of, basically?
Well, this is not a very nice guy. I mean, this is, we're dealing with a person who may have, in fact, started his career with a legitimate interest in justice, but over time became very corrupt and corrupted. He is basically accused of active participation in the Sierra Leone Civil War while he was the president of Liberia, and of supporting his allies there, a group called the Revolutionary United Front, in the prosecution of their war, the brutal prosecution of the war, and the sale of what came to be known as blood diamonds. That is, diamonds that were extracted from Sierra Leone by the Revolutionary United Front and shipped into, smuggled into Liberia, and then sold on the international market.
Now, the first prosecution witness was an expert on blood diamonds. What exactly is the case that the prosecution is trying to make?
They're basically saying, it was sort of dramatized in that film, Blood Diamond. They're saying that what Charles Taylor did was that he was essentially a go-between, that he made Liberia, which itself does not export diamonds in any significance, but he made Liberia a launching pad for these smuggled diamonds to get into Europe, and particularly to get into places like Belgium, and then get on the world market. So that he was an active collaborator in the brutality of the war and supported the Revolutionary United Front in the crimes against humanity and the war crimes that they carried out. So he is directly culpable for the horrendous violence and the destruction of that country.
Briefly, what do we see ahead? How long is this trial going to last, first of all?
It could last months. I would guess that he will be convicted. Charles Taylor does not have a great deal of international support. I think that probably the most controversial issue here, though, is not so much the facts of the trial, but that Charles Taylor left Liberia as part of a peace deal and went to Nigeria, where he believed or had been led to believe that he would be left alone as part of the arrangement for the peace deal. That did not happen. And actually, Farai, that is something that continues to worry me, that his followers, depending on whether he's convicted, may decide to go back to the bush, as they say.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum, and he spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The World Bank estimates that close to 2 billion people around the world don't have electricity. For Mark Bent, a former diplomat and oil executive, that's just unacceptable. Bent has spent the past 20 years living and working in Africa. While visiting a rural village in Eritrea, he noticed residents had no lights for their homes and schools. So he invented a solar-powered flashlight called the BOGO light. Over the past year, he's donated more than 10,000 flashlights to African refugee camps and aid groups. Mark Bent described how his flashlight works.
It's a handheld device. I actually took the inspiration from my wife's shampoo bottle she had hanging in the shower that hooked over the top of the shower curtain. But it has a photovoltaic solar panel, a polysilicone panel on one side, and that generates electricity, which goes through a circuit, a little computer chip, and that in turn stores that energy during the day into three nickel metal hydrate batteries, which provide illumination. LEDs are just fantastic. They're last 75 to 100,000 hours and very, very low power, and they provide enormous amount of light, super bright.
If you were to take this shampoo bottle-shaped flashlight, hang it from the branch of a tree, how many feet out do you think you would see the light flowing?
Well, I was in Ethiopia last May with the United Nations at a refugee camp on the Sudanese border with Dinka, really great people from southern Sudan in the camp. And we were looking at birds at night in the top of trees, and these were five-story trees. The light provides directional light, about 12 to 15 degree directional light, so it's really bright for reading. So about 18 inches away, you can read a book really well. What it doesn't do is provide room illumination. So what we did is Rockefeller Foundation gave us a grant, $20,000, and we used a company called Innocentive, and we found a scientist, an engineer, in New Zealand, and he's helping us design our lights, and we're coming up with a new product, a new model. And one touch of the button will provide light for reading, and the second touch of the button will light up a room 4 meters by 4 meters. And so we're really hoping to corner the market internationally and provide, lights for reading and social interaction and all types of activities after the night falls.
Who's your ideal customer, and how would someone be able to afford one of your flashlights?
That's a great question. We have a program we call BOGO, Buy One, Give One, where the customer is actually the buying customer is an American. And our lights are much, much better than single-use disposable flashlights, which obviously are obsolescent within a few hours, 15 hours or so. And then those batteries normally here in the U.S. get thrown into landfills, which contaminate our groundwater. And so we have a program, this Buy One, Give One BOGO, where an American buys a light for $25, and they get a great light that lasts for 2 years before the batteries need to be rechanged. And that's every single night of use. But that $25 in the BOGO program buys a second light at no more money, and that light is delivered to one of my nonprofit partners in Africa or someplace else in the developing world. And we also give the nonprofit a dollar. So our customer is the American, and our second customer or the grantee is normally somebody living in Africa that can't afford the light itself.
What's the difference, you think, between how people in the U.S. might view a light like yours? For example, living here in the Los Angeles area, people are like, oh, what if there's a power outage? What if there's a riot? This will be my backup. Or when you're talking about some of your people on the continent, are you talking about people's everyday illumination?
Yeah, it's less than 3% of the continent, maybe 4% now has the grid. So what do you do with the rest of it? You're not going to put nuclear in Africa. You're not going to do wind that's going to be able to distribute the energy. You're still going to have the infrastructure question. So you're almost going to have to go with solar. And up to this point, people use kerosene, which is really bad for their environment. It's bad for it's very expensive economically. They spend up to 20 to 30% of their income on kerosene. And here in the United States, we have really no concept of what it means when the sun stops, when the sun goes down. We just walk over to a wall and hit a switch. But to these people, it changes their lives. Just look at education, for example. Most children in Africa are required just for subsistence to have to work during the day. And so at night, when they would have time to read, they can't read because there's no lighting. Every African city you go into, you go past the street light at night, and there's hundreds sometimes of school kids reading at night under streetlights.
What's the best thing anyone has ever told you about the lights that you make?
We got something the other day that really broke my heart in a nice way, in a positive way. And I knew this theoretically before, but we got one from a doctor in a mission hospital in Congo. And he said that they were using our lights to aid in the birthing process for women at night. They made the point in the middle of the paragraph that the first light that the baby saw when they were born was our light. And that just touched me. That really, really touched me, that something that came out of my head, some idea that I had, is now effective. It's really happening. And to me, that's just an amazing thing to think that some newborn, the first light they see is my LEDs. You know, just wonderful.
Mark, thanks for sharing your story.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Mark Bent is founder of Sun Night Solar, makers of the BOGO light, a solar-powered flashlight. He was at member station KUHF in Houston, Texas, and you can find out more about his work and how you can help at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. Today is the actual birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He would have been 79 years old. He may be the nation's best-known pacifist. For him, nonviolence was a major principle and a key strategy to force social change. But Dr. King didn't limit his pacifism to civil rights. It also motivated his public stance against the war in Vietnam. On April 4, 1967, he went to Riverside Church in New York City and publicly announced his opposition to the war.
Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from a speech he called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. We've got with us Claiborne Carson. He's a professor of history at Stanford University. He also directs the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute there. He's with us now. Thanks for coming on.
Good to talk to you.
So that speech was given in 1967, but Dr. King had been concerned about the military escalation in Vietnam for a couple of years. Was this the first time he publicly stated his position?
Well, his position evolved over time. I mean, he was always opposed to the war, but he felt early in the war that he believed, Johnson, that negotiations were going on and that perhaps they should be given time to work. He talked with UN Ambassador Arthur Goldberg and got some reassurances. So he wanted Johnson's support for civil rights issues, and he felt that as long as there was hope that negotiations could work, he should play down his dissent.
President Lyndon Johnson was a Southern Democrat who got the Civil Rights Bill passed in 1964. Some people think that he was kind of dragged kicking and screaming into being a civil rights supporter by, of course, the assassination of President Kennedy. How did Johnson react to King's public announcement about his views on the war?
Very negatively, of course. Johnson was very much in favor of his war policy and felt that that was necessary for all of his supporters, and he was very disturbed that King began to dissent from the war policy, and when you combine that with what was going on in the cities, the rebellions that were going on in Newark and Detroit, and sending troops into the cities, and his sense that King, by identifying himself with the anti-war movement, was kind of fueling the climate of dissent. That led to him, Johnson, kind of giving a free rein to the FBI to go after all of the dissenters, and King was one of the targets.
Well, speaking of dissent, some members of Dr. King's own group, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were opposed to his involvement with the anti-war movement. Here's a little bit more from his Riverside speech.
And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live.
He mentions sadness, and his cadence even sounds deeply saddened. What were the arguments between him and the people that he had held so close? How heated were they?
They were very heated, but in both directions. He had members of his staff who were arguing that he should have taken the stand even earlier. So he was kind of torn in both directions. But I think what he was getting at there is that in his conception, he was a social gospel minister, and that preceded all of his civil rights involvement. In one of his statements, he says, you know, before I'm a civil rights leader, I am fundamentally a preacher of the gospel. And what he meant by that was that it was a gospel about taking the good news to the poor, and he meant the poor of the world. That was his central concern. To some degree, all of the 10 years that he spent as a civil rights leader were a departure from where he really started as a minister, which was his self-conception as a social gospel preacher.
By social gospel, I mean, there have been people who've said Jesus was a radical. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. That's what he's talking about. He says that, you know, some people got their revolutionary ideas from Marx. I got it from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. And he really meant that. It was something deeply ingrained. We just published the sixth volume of the King Papers, and one of the things that becomes clear is that from his teenage years, this is the central thread of his life, that he sees Christianity as an alternative to communism, as an ideology of the poor and oppressed people of the world.
Very briefly, do you think that this contributed to threats against his life?
Oh, of course. You know, there was always the racists out there who were trying to get rid of him because he was a civil rights leader. But I think there was always the charge that he was a communist, which was far from the truth. I mean, as I said, he was trying to find an alternative to communism in terms of dealing with the gulf between rich and poor. But once he took his stand on Vietnam, I think that kind of criticism stepped up, and I think his enemies multiplied. Because before, he had always gotten positive press in the North among the liberal newspapers. But after that, they attacked him too. So he really didn't have very many friends. And this is even before he goes into Memphis and goes into the Poor People's Campaign.
Well, Professor,
we have to
end it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Claiborne Carson is a professor of history at Stanford University. On Tuesdays, we hear from StoryCorps Griot, the project that's recording the stories of African Americans all across the country. Judith Wilson told her story in Oakland, California. In the late 60s, Judith's family lived in a predominantly white neighborhood, and she attended a high school that was also largely white. But during her senior year, one conversation helped her give a perspective that she wasn't getting in school.
My senior year was 69-70, and in my class, there were 200 students. I would say 20 of us were black. And I'll never forget, one of my brothers, Bob, he was, you know, grown up and living on his own. And he'd come home to visit wearing an afro, you know, which was still something quite new and controversial. And my mother went crazy. She just, you know, had an all-out fit, screamed for half an hour, "What have you done to your good hair? What have you done to your good hair?" And he very patiently sat and repeated, "This is my good hair," until she finally chilled out. When he got through with her, he came into my room and sat down and said, "Judy, I know it's not your fault. I went to the same schools you're going to, but I don't think you really understand that you're black." And I'm like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about?" So he, you know, sits down and, you know, really changes my life with this one conversation, because it was true. I didn't know anything about African-American history. And then he also said, your birthday is coming up, and I'm going to bring you something for your birthday that will be, you know, helpful. He brought me the autobiography of Malcolm X and the first volume of poetry by Amiri Baraka, who was then Leroy Jones. And I was taking an honors English class with this nun who, like all of the nuns at our school, were very conservative in many ways. And we were allowed to do an independent study project on an author of our choice. So I do this thesis on Baraka's poetry, which at that point, you know, is full of four-letter words and, you know, sexual references. But she didn't flunk me, you know, because we did have nuns who would do that sort of thing. You know, it was an interesting time. That really changed everything for me.
Judith Wilson went on to become a professor of African-American art history at the University of California, Irvine. The StoryCorps Griot booth is currently in Montgomery, Alabama. All the Griot Initiative recordings are archived at the Library of Congress. A copy of each interview will also go to the National Museum of African-American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Now you can read more stories like this one in the first ever StoryCorps book, Listening is an Act of Love. Hear more at nprnewsandnotes.org.
Support for StoryCorps comes from AT&T, with additional funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music.
Upon a broken guitar.